My name is Tom Kugler, and in an interesting situation, I am the moderator of the track, but not the moderator for the panel. So my job is to introduce the moderator for the panel as the moderator for the track. Now, if that makes any sense to you, you should have tried to explain it during email, going back and forth to people. So anyway, I just give you a quick intro on myself because I think lots of new people for this particular panel. I am the general partner for a company called Porthos Consulting. We do executive level consulting for technology companies. Mostly, we're running around fixing broken companies at this point. So, venture capitalists hire us and have us come in and assume a variety of executive staff positions to kind of get their companies back in a new direction or a different direction. I've written 4 books all about a variety of internet topics. I wrote one of the very first internet marketing books back in 1995. So I've owned 2 different software companies, sold both of those, now live in Bozeman, Montana. So, okay, you don't have to laugh. So, my next door neighbors, Ted Turner and Dennis Quaid, lives down the street. So some other people like Bozeman, Montana, too, I guess. So wanted to go ahead and introduce Michael Drapkin. And Michael is going to be the moderator for this panel. Michael provides senior-level business and technology management consulting services through his company XB5 Partners, I guess, is the correct name. Mr. Drapkin chairs the e-commerce management at Columbia University's Executive Information Technology Management Program. That's a mouthful. And I just heard him tell me that there is finals tonight. So so he's got other things he has to worry about too. He teaches a course on web, internet, and e-commerce. He's also the lead author of a book on e-commerce strategy, organization, and project management called Three Clicks Away, published in March of 2001 by John Wiley & Sons, which is a top-flight publisher. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it on to Michael so he can take over. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. Let's see, who's here today? Okay. Ever since 9/11, I've done a number of speaking engagements, and it's uncertain as to who actually gets the nerve to get on an airplane and come out. So it's sort of a crapshoot to see who of the panelists end up showing up. So bravo to you for supporting our industry. I am, of course, in the chicken since I live here locally, but although to be perfectly fair, I did go out to Comdex a few weeks ago. Anyway. When Internet World contacted me and asked me to moderate this panel, I was amused at this title, EC Visions. To me, it sounded like some kind of a drug-induced reverie amongst a group of industry techno heads, wearing Swami hats and crystal balls, all arguing over the future of XML and middleware, or fighting over what's going to be the next source control system. In fact, that's really not too far off from the description that they had sent me. So, however, if you're looking for the nitty-gritty on specific technologies that will emerge, I'm not sure that's what's going to happen in this session. Because the fact of the matter is that we've got, in this panel, is mostly CEOs. We've got a VP of Marcom and BizDev. Nobody who comes from the CIO or CTO background, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? What's much more important to me, and what I believe would ultimately be of much more benefit to you as an audience, would be for you to come away from today's panel with some kind of insight as to how to understand the value chain. How to see the implications of all the dynamic industry changes that are going on around us on a constant basis, and what you need to do in order to identify them, understand them, and most importantly, how to act. Now, at the end of the day, it's the actions that we take, that's all that really counts. And all the theory or hot tips in the world don't really mean anything unless they really change what you decide you're going to do. So it's really your ability to act and achieve results, that's really all that matters. So case in point, I used to work for a chairman who was a real visionary, and he loved to rankle his competition by publishing all of his proprietary business plans in the industry newsletters that everybody in his industry would read. He didn't care if people knew his plans. It was basically his way of saying, you know, try and stop me. Here's what I'm going to do. He reminded me of a general that would be, he'd ride out to confer before the battle with the opposing general, with, you know, the big armies, the medieval armies in lines facing each other in the movies. And he'd ride out to the other opposing general, and he would say, here's my battle plan, now try and stop me, right? And I'm going to defeat you, and there isn't a thing that you can do about it. Kind of unnerving, isn't it? Another one was a TV ad I used to see where a news photographer would be snapping pictures at some impromptu news conference, and he would say to us, the audience, as an aside, he'd say, you can't have my eye, but you can have my camera. So my point here is that you can have all the hot tips in the world, but if you don't understand what to do with it, then it's useless. So what does it mean? What is the context? How will it change my actions? So let me see if I can break down the process, and hopefully my colleagues will expand on what I'm saying to a certain extent on what I'm about to say. So the first thing is that you have to gain and fuel your own vision. How do you do this? Well, you can read all of our industry newsletters, newspapers, magazines, and they're great for telling you what has already happened. But guess what? It's too late. It's just like they tell you on Wall Street, if you buy on the news, it's too late. All the movement's already gone. All the media that we get are pretty much tactical. The two magazines that I read to find out what technology firms are doing 6 months, a year, 2 years out in advance, and I hope you don't think this is off the wall, but I actually read Popular Science and Popular Mechanics. Now, I know that sounds kind of weird, but if you actually read these magazines, they're one of the few magazines that actually tell you what's coming down the road, you know? And go subscribe. They're cheap. They're a cheap crystal ball to pick up if you want to find out the technology that's coming down the road. It actually works. So the next question is, how do you gain insights into the significance of all this information that's out there, just like the general's plan? So the first answer is experience. And I can't really help you with that. The best arbiter of vision is your own gut instinct. You have to look at these things and say, does this stuff make sense to me or does it not? And all that is really derived from experience and intuition. One you can gain on your own, and the other one is God-given, comes at the factory. The second answer is practice. Like many things, developing a vision isn't a lot different from developing a good free throw, as both are things that need to be developed by practicing. But you have to go out and do them. You're not going to get this merely by working as an employee for somebody else's company. My experience has been that very few people in a firm of any given size are actually spending any significant amount of time thinking beyond what they do in their day-to-day job basis. It's difficult to develop a vision and generate a vision when all you're concerned about are the things that you do for one firm. Now, in my role as a consultant, I'm lucky. I talk to a lot of different companies. I see a lot of different things going on. So it gives me the opportunity to see the larger potential of the relationships between different firms and industries. And as a practical matter, it gives me the ability to call up some CEOs of some fairly significant sized firms and say, hey, I've got an idea for your firm. And to my great surprise, they usually say, I want to know about it. Why? Well, who else is out there thinking about their company? The people inside their company, there's only a handful of people. How many people on the outside? You know, we all take care of what we need to do on a daily basis. So if you want to develop a vision, you have to be looking at what's going on out there, even though we're deluged by information on a daily basis. So, you know, you've got to spend this time. You have to expend time and effort to develop a good vision. And I think about the marketplace all the time, not just 9 to 5, although I don't work 9 to 5. You've got to push out of your box, and you've got to look at what is going on in the world around you if it's important to you. Okay. The second area that I just want to touch on before I turn over to our speakers here, our panel, is evaluating the value proposition that your marvelous vision has helped you to identify. So your vision should help you to understand where the world is moving to. When the world moves, it creates needs and demands. These are where the opportunities lie, in these unfilled demands. Technologies will arise to fill these needs. As the old saying is, nature abhors a void, right? By the way, I usually explain the meaning of that phrase, nature abhors a void, to my Columbia students by saying, picture this. I'm driving up the West Side Highway in a car, and I leave a little too much space between me and the car in front of me. What's going to happen? Well, some jerk is going to pull in front of me. I mean, that's just nature. When you give an opportunity, someone's going to fill that, fill up that void. Now, if you think that your vision, if you perceive a demand somewhere, chances are that many other people are probably thinking the same thing that you are. That's the way our capitalist society operates. And thank God we live in a country where we can dream and build our own destinies. Now, I see a lot of interesting ideas all the time, either from people I know, or you see them in the press, or my own, or even at panel discussions like these. And over the years, I have developed what I call Drapkin's Rules of Intrinsic Business Value. And here they are. In order to for a business idea or concept to have some kind of value to it, they have to fulfill one of the following criteria. And by the way, you hear a lot of different people with their own set, but this is my set. My set is something has to either save or make people money. It's either got to make people's lives easier, and this is one that my Columbia students made me add to the list, it's got to have some kind of recreational or entertainment value. So the last one is there so I can justify why Britney Spears is in this world doing what she does. So if one of these ideas doesn't fulfill one of these criteria, don't waste your time. It has no value. Okay? And this is where you have to use your gut instinct to look at this and say, does this make any sense to me? Does it make any sense at all? Is this going to be a sustainable business? So another thing to look for is where the money is going. Now, you can follow the money trail, but you have to beware, be very careful. Lots of money went into the dot-com craze, right? And we all know what happened there. Look at the money flow really as an indicator of larger trends and temper it with a real healthy dose of common sense. Don't get caught up in trendy things. Don't be a lemming. Look at the dot-coms, countless firms with no intrinsic value, no intrinsic business value. Look at even wireless. You know, wireless is supposed to be the next big hot thing. You know, grand technologies looking for solutions. And whenever you see that, a technology looking for solution, that should sort of like set an alarm that maybe there really isn't a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Especially with all the grand failures. We've seen a lot of failures in wireless recently. Yada Yada fell the other day. A couple other companies in the wireless space all died. So, when it's all said and done, stick to the basics, supply and demand. The web blossomed because there was pent-up demand for another way to communicate, right? All that was required was a way to connect everybody's computers that were already in their homes through the internet, right? Somebody just figured out how to tie it all together, and suddenly, wow, people said, wow, this is great. Does anybody think that the spectacular demise of dot-coms and the crash of the NASDAQ and our recession and 9/11, that e-commerce is doomed? Raise your hand if you think e-commerce is dying. Nobody? Okay, it's not dying. Really is not. It's stabilizing. E-commerce is becoming yet another sales channel, and it's not being ignored. It's not being ignored by big corporations. There are a lot of heavy dollars going in that area right now. Maybe there aren't as many crazy startups going on, but you know, don't underestimate what's going on the industry right now. There's a lot of things that are happening. So what does that mean? Where's the void? What are you going to do about it? So take on the challenge. Everything you need to succeed is out there. Thank you. So that having been said, I'd like to introduce my panelists. I'm going to start with Patrick Byrne, who's the CEO and president of Overstock.com. Yeah, Patrick has built a professional reputation upon his ability to locate undervalued and distressed companies and manage their turnaround. In 1999, over 100 internet business plans passed through his lap in Park City. What a nice place to have an office. You know, you and Tom ought to get together because he's in Bozeman, which of course is at Big Sky.
Right.
No, you know, no coincidence there. So he gave a quick note to all except for Overstock.com. Patrick calculated that while the internet would prove disastrously inefficient at competing with normal retail channels, it was tailor-made for liquidation due to the unique difficulties associated with liquidation of excess inventory in the offline world. He immediately acquired a majority stake in the company and assumed the role as president and CEO. Patrick launched Overstock.com in October 1999 to bring shoppers the best deals online for brand-name consumer merchandise. During the year to follow, internet pundits were claiming that the key to becoming a top e-commerce site was to concentrate on branding. The more you spend, the greater the mind share. And naturally, it's kind of disappointing going through Times Square these days. We don't have all those crazy dot-com ads anymore, do we? I guess we have to live with just the World Wrestling Federation. Patrick and his executive team were not persuaded by those kinds of conventional wisdom. They based their business decisions on the principles of value investing, rejecting offers from venture capitalists that pushed them to follow the rules of the new economy. Whatever happened to the new economy? Nobody talks about that anymore. As a result, the company's sales have increased from $2 million in 1999 to just short of $40 million in 2000, while Overstock.com has built and maintained one quarter of the traffic of Amazon.com. Patrick is especially proud that Overstock.com reached profitability with no outside funding and expects this year's sales to reach $100 million. You still on track?
Sure.
All right.
9,500.
Excellent. Okay. To Patrick's right is John McElhenney, the Chief Executive Officer of SolidWorks Corporation. I especially like his bio here. Whoever your PR person is, I want to meet them. John's rise to CEO at SolidWorks Corporation was built on his strong record of results. He built his career at SolidWorks as VP of Far East Distribution in 1996 and quickly built the company's first sales channel in that part of the world. Next, he developed the strategy for the company's solution partner program, which has grown to 300 certified partners in a variety of industries and resulted in more customers and increased revenues. As Vice President of North American Sales, he developed the product marketing team, which has helped position the company into its current lead role in the mid-range CAD market, where it has secured more than 160,000 customers. He also played a key role in creating SolidWorks subscription services, a recurring revenue stream that nets the company more than $30 million annually. Now as CEO, he leads SolidWorks Corp from finance to marketing, sales, and product development. His mission: to strengthen collaborative relationships with customers and partners and build an internal corporate culture that encourages excellence. Prior to joining SolidWorks, he held management positions at Computer Vision, where he was involved in everything from product development to equity refinancing. Previous to that, he ran one of Raytheon's product design and development pre-production teams for defense-related products. He began his career at Raytheon as an engineer in prototype manufacturing, where he was engaged in all aspects of product development and manufacturing. Was this in Long Island or California?
Boston.
Oh, well, missed that one. John has a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Rochester, which is also my alma mater, a master's degree in manufacturing systems from Boston University, which is my wife's alma mater, and an MBA in marketing from Northeastern University. To John's right, I'd like to now introduce Alan Koritsky, who's the Vice President of Marketing for Flerion. In this role, Alan is responsible for strategy, marcom, product marketing, and branding. He brings over 25 years of datacom and wireless industry experience to Flerion. Excuse me. Before joining Flerion, Mr. Koritsky was most recently the VP of Sales for Aether Systems, a world leader in wireless solution software solutions. At Aether, he defined market strategy, developed new products, and increased sales by 75%. Prior to Aether, Mr. Koritsky led France Telecom's North American sales and marketing operations, where he was actively involved in developing the company's successful $5.5 billion expansion strategy. At AT&T, Mr. Koritsky held the position of sales director. Under his leadership, sales to enterprises increased by 40%. Mr. Koritsky also headed AT&T's data communication new product development group and ran AT&T's product marketing organization responsible for supporting over $3 billion in data communication services. Prior to AT&T, he was an analyst at IDC, International Data Corporation. Mr. Koritsky has published a number of articles in the area of telecommunications marketing and is an award recipient from the Institute of Management Scientists. He holds an MBA from New York University, in addition to an MS in communications research and BA in behavioral sciences from Boston University. So there you have it. We've got a pretty heavy duty panel here of people who have really practiced what they preach, hopefully today anyway. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask each of them to speak, and we'll have a little bit of a discussion, and think about what questions you want to ask our panel here. Okay, Patrick, you want to take it away?
Sure. I suppose I should have asked you this beforehand, but how long would you like me to speak?
Ten minutes.
Oh, I can be much shorter than that.
Okay, whatever you like.
Okay. People get bored, I think, listening to
Me speak so far.
Interaction is much better.
You have to wake them up now that I've been droning on.
Okay. There is a guy in Omaha named Warren Buffett who has a great metaphor for the market. He says that the market, you should think of the market like you own a barbershop and you've got a partner who's a drunk manic depressive, and his name is Mr. Market. And he comes in some days thinking the barbershop business is the greatest thing in the world, and God is going to go to the moon. He'll buy your half for way, and he'll pay you way too much money for it. That's the other thing. Mr. Market will give you a buy-sell quote minute by minute all day long. He'll, some days he's in a great mood, a manic mood. He'll offer way too much money for your half. Other days he comes in, he's depressed. Hears everyone's buying scissors. Everyone's going to start cutting their hair at home. No more barbershops. And he wants to sell you his half for way too little money. And your job as an investor or a business person is to learn to screen out the moods of Mr. Market and just understand what the real value of a business is and not worry about the mania and depressions of Mr. Market. And the real value of a business is pretty simple to figure out. It's a function of how much money it makes. And it's pretty much that simple. We at Overstock sort of take those lessons to heart. I grew up very much in that school of value investing. There's also it's an oddity in English. We say make money in the sense of if you start a toothbrush factory and you operate it successfully and have sales and watch your expenses, you make money. But you also make money in English if you buy some swamp land in Florida and flip it to widows and orphans. We also say, well, I made money. But it's a totally different verb in my mind. Our focus has always been on the first. It's literally grounds for dismissal in our company to talk about an IPO, to talk about what analysts think, what the stock market's going to think, what reporters think. We literally do not care, and it's grounds for dismissal to let it enter the decision process, what any outside party is going to think. One theory of value investing is that you buy a share of stock if and only if the company, if the market were going to shut down for 10 years tomorrow, would you still buy that share of stock? So you're not thinking of yourself as buying a piece of paper and trying to catch it on an uptick. You're buying a slice of a company. Corollary of that is you run a company as if there is no outside market. Our motto from the beginning is the best exit strategy is getting profitable. So that's sort of the general overview of the approach we take. I chose liquidation. It amazes me to this day that so much money went into funding the businesses that they went into. Businesses that I think a sophomore economics student could have explained were nonsense business models. You know, auctioning commodities on the internet, auctioning consumer electronics, auctioning a commodity market and a commodity product in a perfect market is like the definition of an awful business. And yet hundreds of millions of dollars went into support several different variants of that business plan. In general, I think that the internet is good at, or e-commerce is good at doing and only doing just those things that meat space is not good at doing. So in terms of selling physical products, for example, take the book industry. The book industry is a very mature industry where all the fat has been wrung out of it by competition over the years. How anyone got funded, and it isn't like selling books through the internet. You really shave out a lot of distribution costs. In fact, it's probably just as expensive or more expensive to FedEx books than to truck them to somebody's local bookstore. So how anyone got money to fund an online bookstore seems also improbable to me. It's just an intrinsically lousy business. You can pretty much go down the list of the B2C businesses, and they were intrinsically awful businesses that should never been funded. The only exception is, and that's because the internet really does not squeeze out distribution costs. I think that they were funded mostly by people who had a George Jetson view of the world. Hey, I'm going to punch a button and something shows up at my door. And you know, the truth is, when you buy a book in a bookstore, about 18% of what you pay for was the distribution cost. And it turns out to cost just about that much for book companies to send you books through Federal Express. So what the internet is great at doing is sucking out not distribution costs, but information costs. So meat space businesses that are really plays on information costs are good ones to move on to the internet. Just so happens that liquidation is one of them, flea markets is another. But liquidation is the American retail system is set up to handle mass quantities of identical goods. It's not set up to handle what an economist would call a fragmented supply, very small lots from very numerous sources. That's not what the American retail system is very good at. Well, so the internet does turn out to be good at that. So once I understood how the liquidation industry worked, there's about 400 guys around the country called jobbers, and they're fellows like off that show The Sopranos. They're a bunch of guys named, you know, Louie and Vinny, I got a deal for you on some sickle watches if you do this for me on Polaroid. It's 400 guys in their attics sending each other faxes and stuff. It's this incredibly inefficient market from an information point of view. So it's perfect. And that's just what the internet is meant to compete with, markets that are inefficient from an information in terms of information costs. So we started Overstock.com. I was turned down by about 30 different venture capitalists in 1999. Went all over with my suitcase around Silicon Valley. I'm probably the only guy in 1999 who got turned down for venture capital in Silicon Valley. I, since that day, have liquidated 18 different dead.coms, most of them funded by the very same people who turned me down for my investment.
So they ultimately funded you cheaper.
Right. If I weren't as mature as I am, I would take some undue satisfaction in that. So that's the story of Overstock.com. Okay.
Great. SolidWorks Corporation, just the company that I joined when we first came to market in 1996, provides what's called solid modeling software. And it impacts all of our lives from the standpoint of whether it was the coffee maker this morning that you touched, or the shower handle or your car radio. all these products are designed. And what solid modeling allows people to do is design them better, more efficiently, more aesthetically pleasing. So if you look at even the remote control at your house, it used to be this, you know, sort of rectangular item. Now it's sort of got swoopy shapes and very curved type surfaces. That's what solid modeling allows people to do. Now, what I think I learned over the past several years, and as we've learned taking our core capabilities and bringing them to the internet, are a couple of key things. And for us, selling value is not necessarily a market-related activity or understanding the intrinsic value. Software, the marginal cost is effectively zero. And so there are competitive dynamics, but ultimately it's understanding what value you create with the customer and what they'd be willing to pay. And it truly is something that you have to measure on a very regular basis because of the competitive dynamics. And I would say just two things that I would share with you that I think are valuable lessons. And as people create companies, I think so many people invested in so many crazy companies. And thank God we weren't one of those investors, if you will, which is people talked about these large untapped markets. And there was something I learned way back when, which is there's no such thing as a large untapped market. There are such things as large untapped potential markets. But if people aren't spending money, then it's a potential market. And so a lot of people bet on potential. And they started confusing the notion of large markets with potential markets. And I would say the other thing that I think we've learned at SolidWorks, and today we're about a $120 million company, growing quite rapidly and profitable, about 30% operating income company, very, very, very strong growth since 96, is the fundamental thing about beta testing. And I don't mean beta testing the software. I mean about beta testing the wallet. And so many people try to give free things. I was at a Christmas party on Saturday night, and a buddy of mine was there and his wife, and he was sort of showing me his new cell phone. And he said, they actually paid me to take this cell phone. He went through sort of the economics of how many people gave him rebates and coupons to buy things. And at the end of the day, for his two-year sort of subscription, if you will, to whatever service, you know, they paid him $100-something for his phone. It's just absurd. Those economics don't work. And when I see all these free trials of software and free trials of things, I guess what I would ultimately say is if you want to make sure that you're creating value, you've got to ask people to pay for it. So beta testing the wallet would be the one thing I would say to people, that more companies fail because they fail to test that than they test the quality or they test the functionality of the product.
Hi. I'm VP of Marketing at Flarion Technologies, and most of you probably have no idea what Flarion does because we don't have any sales yet. Flarion offers a AirLink technology to cell phone companies that allow for affordable mobile broadband. And we're in market trials with a number of operators, and hopefully you'll hear about us next year. I want to talk for a second, too, about mobile broadband and then maybe a little bit about the technology. First of all, let me see a show of hands. How many people have looked up product information, a car or stereo, whatever, on the internet? Everybody. Okay. How many people have purchased some item via the internet? Everybody. Okay. How many people have cell phones? How many people have bought an item wirelessly over the internet? No one. Not surprisingly. The technology today to encourage mobile commerce simply is not there. And I think this, I would imagine that this group of people is probably a little bit above average as far as technologically oriented people. And yet this very stunning example, but by no means atypical. So what we really need is a technology that will really facilitate mobile commerce. And as we can tell right now, it's not available. Now, when will it be available and what is needed? First of all, if you look at what retailers really want to do, they want to have the same rich experience that you have already experienced on the internet. They want color graphics, sound. You want to be able to interact with the demo. You want to have that rich instant gratification that gets you excited to actually buy the product. And retailers spend millions, if not billions of dollars on their brand, and they don't want it to be some type of just text-oriented commoditizing listing. They want to actually sell their product. That needs to be enabled by a technology. There are many reasons why that's not the case in the mobile wireless environment, one of which is the network itself. Another reason is the browsers are incompatible, and also the sheer confusion between different companies. If you look at one device, it may not work. For example, Palm may not work and does not work, for example, on a PCS cellular network, and there are so many more examples. So what's really needed is a AirLink that allows you to have the exact same experience that you know and love on the internet, and a device that can interact with the internet as well. There are many examples of why mobile commerce does make sense. And if you go back to what Michael said, does it make money or save money? Is it easier? Does it save you time? Or does it actually entertain you? There's some great examples. Making money, if you're a retailer and you can reach out to more customers and get more channels and differentiate yourself and retain customers, and if it's really a rewarding experience, that's going to make money for a retailer. Saving time, making yourself more productive. How many people have a RIM BlackBerry? Okay, does it help you during the day to be more productive? We have one no and one maybe. The theory, at least, is that there are those slices of time when you're not spending it productively that you can actually give yourself back some time, and that's another point. The last point was the entertainment part. If there's a Madonna concert or a shareholder meeting or some type of entertainment in terms of music, if it's available to you and it's easy and cheap, and you want it when you have those downtimes, that's another aspect of how do you get that information and how do you get it in a way that's very entertaining. Well, mCommerce has that promise, but it's not there now. And if, for example, if you're leaving here and you find out that your flight's going to change, you want to get an alert, or if you want to use some type of movie phone to find out where the movie is and you don't want to spend a lot of time looking it up, you want to do it on the fly. The fact that you have location-specific and time-specific information can, in fact, make you more productive if it's done correctly. So what's the problem? Why is it that the networks aren't available? What do you need? Well, first of all, you need a broadband network. You need a network that's in the hundreds of kilobits, not in the 20 or 30 kilobits. It has to be screaming fast so that the image comes on and you can interact with it the way you normally would in the internet. Secondly, you need to have a common ability, a browser that interacts with all the content of the internet today and be totally interactive. If you want to have a demo, you want to have a browser that works with TCP/IP, not some other version that doesn't work with all the applications, the billions of pages that are there today. Another important thing is you need to have very inexpensive broadcast capability, or multicast, which is on the internet today. And that has to transcend the boundary of wired to the wireless world, and that's something that you also would have to have in order to have everybody in this room to watch President Bush right now talk about hopefully catching one of the terrorists or maybe some other more entertaining situation. But you can't do that in a wireless environment today unless you have multicasting. You also need, of course, things that you go without saying. You need coverage everywhere. You need it to be inexpensive. If you get a bill for a mobile broadband that's $40 in 1 month and then you accidentally left on the device and it's $1,400 the next month, you aren't going to use it. So it has to be a fixed all-you-can-eat price. So the real question is there a technology in the future, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, or in the near-term future? Guess what? There's something out there, and it may not be as far as you think.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Normally what I would do at this part of a panel is pose some of my canned questions to the panelists, but really something tells me that I should ask you guys what are the specific things you want to hear. So I actually want to ask for some questions right now that'll sort of frame our discussion in the remaining time. Somebody want to raise their hand and say, what do you want to hear? What do you want to know? Raise your hand. Don't make me have to. Oh, thank you. I was about to have to call on one of you.
Okay, so our first two speakers said they didn't think that the value was in on the retail side, and the third one did. So I'd like to hear you guys argue about that.
Okay, guys, so where's e-commerce going? Where's the value? Who wants to jump into that? Who wants to step into that one?
Well, I think it's just a perspective of the clue. In today's world, there's business-to-business type of activity going on independent of the internet, and the internet's facilitating it. And there's also businesses to consumers. Our particular industry happens to focus more on other businesses. So from my perspective, I have no retail sort of experience. I'm a consumer, and I buy a lot, and so does my wife, unfortunately. But there's a lot of activity happening online relative to to the retail side, but why don't you, I don't have experience in that space.
Yeah, you know, there are different definitions of e-commerce. I believe it's not an either-or situation. Certainly you have a B2C and you have a B2B situation, and clearly enterprise, if you're a salesperson or a construction worker, healthcare worker, field technician, and you can make your day more productive, that's commerce, and that's certainly, if you don't have to go back to the office or you get information right when you need it, it's easy, that's going to be very productive. On the other hand, everybody I just mentioned and all the residential people are consumers at the end of the day, and so they have needs to buy cars and stereos or look up information or find out about entertainment. And so I think it's simply both. And if the technology makes it easier, faster, better, cheaper, it'll work for both segments.
Okay, well, Alan, how come wireless has really not succeeded so far? You're saying it's solely because of the bandwidth limitations?
Well, also, by the way, security is another issue, too. Bandwidth limitations feed into that. But it's simply not easy, and it's not the same experience that you have on the wired world right now. It's just not the depth and the value of the application isn't worth the effort at this point.
Right.
Would there be just intrinsic constraints on how rich you're going to be able to make that experience? In other words, even with broadband, I would imagine surfing on a cell phone is always going to be
difficult,
and people, you know, there's only so much work you're going to want to do there. And for example, I'm not sure that retail, although there have been different, I think Amazon and different people have set themselves up and have had fairly meager results from what I've heard. People just don't shop for things, for example, on handheld. And even if you have broadband and everything else, do you think there just might be that intrinsic constraint? The size of the screen? And
There's no question that that the size of the screen has some impact on that. But right now, the devices we look at today, and I'm thinking more, since this is a visions view of the world, I'm thinking where the technology is going in terms of the ability for higher resolution, color, battery, and the ergonomics of some of these devices that are coming out. If you look where it's going to be 2 or 3 years from now, it won't be the same as your desktop. But if you look at some of the laptops coming out now, which are a couple of pounds and are very, very powerful, and you look at where the technology is going in the future, not exactly the same experience, but getting very, very close. It's a moving target. But to me, the biggest limitation is what you actually see on a small laptop or on a pocket PC right now. If it's done in broadband, which, as you can imagine, since I come from Flarion, we do that, it's a very, very different experience than when if you're looking through a narrowband situation.
But I think the experience, though, over the past couple of years after there's been this huge shakeout is that wasn't there a lot of contrived sort of business plans, contrived businesses and contrived experiences?
But there always are. That's always the case. It's nature of the beast.
And there will be some practical application somebody will develop that somebody will absorb, you know. But the fact of the matter is there was roadkill in phase one, and there'll be roadkill in phase two. But, you know, there's a lot of contrived markets that will not materialize, and there will be some pragmatic things. Think of some of the PDA devices now. What's really taking off in the GIS and civil markets now in mapping. You know, I don't have to be in that space, but I'm very familiar with it. A lot of the geographic information systems type of utility companies now are using PDAs with GPS to be able to, you know, make modifications real time as to what's going on in terms of specific locations about utilities or about related information. And that's sort of a net benefactor, if you will. So think of it as a forest fire. You know, after the forest fire, some life comes about. That will happen in phase two of this because there's a lot of contrived situations that people are betting on.
Well, the only reason why the whole GPS thing is around is because our government spent a lot of money for the military to put satellites up in the air in order for us to be able to target bombs and other things when the military do what they do. So there was a whole infrastructure that already existed for that. Similarly, we have all this infrastructure of fiber that's been laid down for the internet. So far, we still don't really have that on the wireless side. And the bigger problem on the wireless side, of course, is nobody has really come up to me and said, you got to have this thing. You know, you can't live without it. I mean, and those kind of things happen. Out of nowhere, somebody will come up with something. There'll be a gem in the middle of something. For example, you know, I'm not a big proponent of BlackBerry, but clearly BlackBerry has made inroads into a market that nobody ever believed would be able to be changed. Or, you know, we thought that there was the market for search sites on the web were saturated, then suddenly Google comes out of nowhere and suddenly they take over the market. Now, what is that? What is it that you have to have? What's that spin that is going to make these fundamental shifts or create new markets that weren't there before?
The next big area, I think, taking wireless will be repair and maintenance. Repair and maintenance, if you take the UPS guy coming to your house, think about how efficient that become. Before it used to be a clipboard and the guy logging down what he picked up when. Now everything is systematized, everything's barcode and bar scanned. You can know within 10 minutes, plus or minus, what your package is. Well, with wireless and high-speed wireless, in the product design arena, one of the things we're working towards is compacted streaming graphics formats to be able to allow people to be able to get access to product design information. So you can imagine in the repair and maintenance sort of operations for airlines or any kind of products, if you will, especially things that are mobile,
right.
Having remote access to be able to deal with graphic information will allow things to I think that'll be one of the areas you'll see a huge amount of investment and a huge amount of opportunity for wireless.
Patrick, what do you think?
I actually think that sounds right on. I think that sounds right on. It's the areas, again, it's where meat space doesn't do something well. Well, if you're a...
You want to define meat space for the audience here?
Meat space, the physical world. Physical world. Don't you use that?
M-E-A-T, not M-E-A-T.
No, M-E-A-T. Meat, physical meat, as opposed to virtual, cyber, meat space, you know, where we all live and breathe. Well, being a mechanic on a Boeing or in the military on an F-17 or something, you don't want to. Sure, they may have 200 manuals or at least 20 to 30 manuals per job, and big thick books, and that's an application I've heard of. And I think that makes a lot of sense, and that probably does require kind of broadband to carry the graphics that you're speaking of, Alan. Besides that, information, other than that, I think that it's going to be information that has some real timeliness. Like, well, now there's, with Sprint, some preliminary steps towards you can search for movies and such on. Things that you wouldn't want to go back to your office for. Also news and things like that. But I think that actually retail shopping is not something that will migrate. You know, going to Amazon and order something is not something that's going to migrate to handhelds.
The way I would envision it is, it's like everybody's been to a presentation where somebody puts up a presentation and there's just lots of gratuitous graphics that have nothing to do with the key point the person's trying to make. And I remember the first presentation class I ever took, this sort of said, you know, and there's a great book, by the way, if somebody wants a book by this guy, Steve Krug. And he talks about, don't make me think, is what he's a user interface expert. And he has one chapter, and he calls it, eliminate unnecessary words, and he's got unnecessary crossed out. And, you know, I remember my first presentation class, they sort of said, you know, don't use gratuitous graphics. And I think, like anything else, there's so many, you know, illustrations that are required for the capability to demonstrate the technology, and a lot of people will make a bet on that, and there'll be a lot of gratuitous graphics, if you will, on wireless technology and new applications. And, you know, they'll ultimately go away and some real practical applications will emerge. And I think on the commerce side, I think it's just, you know, nobody goes and buys a car online. You know, even now, in the wired world, nobody goes and buys a car online. What people do is they research it, they interrogate it, they compare it, they find out information, and they go and they may ultimately complete the transaction, but they'll typically will be going and driving the car first.
Right.
So I think it's more about, I would say the key word for 2002 and beyond is pragmatism, you know, being pragmatic.
Sure. Why don't we take some more questions? Sir, you had a question?
I think Michael's statement about, you know, what could fundamentally change the very specific area, intelligence agents.
Mm. Yeah, what happened to that anyway? They made a big hoopla about that about a year and a half ago.
Strategy.
My question is, right now you can think of intelligence agents as just a easier way for people to do search. But when it comes down to, you know, later in the future, intelligence agents are doing what the people envision them to do, and maybe have instant always-on internet in the home and such, is there some sort of marketplaces that could be fundamentally changed because of that?
Intelligent agents is an IA, right? So sort of like AI backwards.
Right.
I'm not an expert on intelligent agents, but what I do know is that the good news is that searching's gotten much easier on the web. The bad news is it's still very prehistoric and Cro-Magnon, and it's kind of like writing like this, you know. Do I think that there's clearly use for something that provides the right information to the right person at the right time? So ultimately, somebody will figure out where the value is. I don't know where that value is, but there is value. There's no doubt that going through, and Andy Rooney, I don't know if anybody saw 60 Minutes, he talked about the New York Times. He talked how many, did anybody see it? He talked about how many words are actually in the New York Times, and he said if you read it cover to cover, or you know, page to page, every single word in there, and you read, I think he sort of said something like 80 hours a week. It would take you 3 weeks to read the whole New York Times. And the good news is when you finish, you'd have two more to read. So it's the same thing with the information explosion. And so somebody who provides the right value at the right time, the question is, how will they monetize that and how will they make a business out of it? Because at the end of the day, it's about business.
Right.
If you think of the wireless impact of that, if you have a store locator or you're in a town and you happen to be at a location, the fact that you have a certain time in a certain location, the agent can help you on that. It's more or less a mobile concierge. But getting back to Michael's point about, Jig, you got to have that. How many people have either cable or DSL in their home? If I were to tell you it's going to be out for the next week, would that be an inconvenience to you? If I told that to my 15-year-old son, it would be more than an inconvenience. It's something 5 years ago, if I told you it was going to go out, you'd say, who cares? But all of a sudden, it's a dependency that you have. And some of these applications or some of these capabilities are things that it's very, very hard to test in advance. But once you have it, it's hard to let go. So it's very hard to trial test these. Sometimes you have to give it to people and then take it away, and they say, nope, I'll keep it.
Right. More questions? Who else? Sir. Well, I think the overriding fundamental problem is that, you know, we want things. And when it comes to the web, we see it and the internet as a source of information. And we want to find whatever it is that we're looking for when we want it. In fact, we want it ready for us before we even get there. And the problem is that we're humans. We don't have an Ethernet cable in our brain yet. So we're limited to the physical ways that we have of being able to interact with that environment. And a lot of them are very problematic. getting back to your intelligent agents problem, one of the problems with that is that data is very hard to rationalize across all sorts of different systems in any kind of efficient manner. So will there be intelligent agents? Well, maybe, but I think it's only ever going to do as well as a subset of the data that's out there because it's too hard to do. And it's always changing. It's a moving target. So I think that whole thing is a real problem. I mean, I have a my little cell phone that's got the little thing on here, you know, the little browser. And I thought, gee, that's a real cool thing. And of course, I subscribed to it for a month, which was the minimum, because the first time you try it, you say, this is totally unusable. And that is the problem, is the usability. You can't use these things, and the things that you're going to be able to use that are going to meet some kind of a need or demand are the ones that are going to succeed. And finding those are the problem.
Yeah, there was a major analyst came out with a big report on wireless technology and said, gee, isn't it great that people won't be wearing watches in the future because they have clocks on their cell phone. And I said to myself, yeah, maybe so. I've had this for years, but excuse me, I'm keeping this the way it is because the ergonomics make sense for me to have two devices. If someone wants to have a little small voice device and want to have a little data device, which is actually easier to surf, or PDA, whatever, and the form factor is more usable, that may be the way to go in the future. There are different segments will have different. I would never subscribe personally to what Michael was saying is the way to go, and that's why I would have the same reaction. It just doesn't make sense ergonomically. I'm not really focusing on the device, which is there are many different segments. I was really focusing on the network. But you know, there's another factor. If you look at, there was an article today in the Times about the fact that people aren't using digital printers because they're just keeping them and storing them digitally. And all I could think of, that was the reason why I would go with digital, because I have a hard time storing all my pictures. It becomes a whole different experience. What do? You're communicating now digitally. If you're taking pictures and you're sending it immediately to your friends, it's now a communications vehicle. If you're having a video conference, it's a totally different experience. And we can't just take the old experience. We have to see where we're going because of the communications and the personalization. It's just not the same. It's hard to imagine where we're going to go.
Right. You know, there's an inverse relationship between capability and ease of use. So, for example, we all poo-poo our POTS lines, right? Our plain old telephone service, you know, our dial tone analog system. But you know what? When was the last time you picked up your phone and you didn't get a dial tone? You know, and of course, without there being a problem, you know, with weather or something, or somebody digging up your sidewalk. But the idea is we all take that for granted. Yet we use wireless and we pick up a phone, and we're never really sure whether we even, when you push the send button, nothing happens. When was the last time you dialed a phone call on a regular POTS line that nothing happened? Very rarely. And that's kind of the problem, is as you increase the complexity of what you try to do, it's very difficult to make it easy for you to use, or you know, to increase the capability there. Do we have more questions out here? Ma'am.
Can you talk about biometrics and what kind of effect on the internet in the future, and if it's going to be successful?
Go ahead.
I think it's one of the dirty little secrets of internet B2C commerce is how much fraud there is. There's a heck of a lot more that's being reported. We have gone to some lengths, both at Overstock, both through writing our own, basically writing some algorithms that pull out certain types of orders that, obviously I'm not gonna say what they are, because there's all kinds of ways you can spot somebody's orders. And then we just give them to a young lady who sits there and calls. And through that, we've gotten fraud down from about 4% to 0.2 or 0.3%. And it's just because there's a telephone call and we get the credit card and the customer on the line and do a confirmation. But in the process of that, we've talked to other credit card, you know, people in this industry, and the credit card industry, and they say that people are experiencing 3 to 5%.
Yeah, that's good, by the way.
3 to 5% is
yes. So yeah, compared to what it used to be. Did you know that American Express used to run their card as a loss leader?
Really?
But they actually lost money from fraud before they put in these elaborate security systems.
Well, we're down to 0.3 now, and it's just because
that's outstanding.
But you just have to sit and bang the phone with them. I see quickly going to. I think very quickly people are going to start having to enter the four, it'll be accepted that you enter the numbers that are not embossed on the card, but the security numbers. The industry itself can't tolerate that. The credit card companies can't pay for it. So that's going to be, imply, I think, a shift towards biometrics. I'm not quite sure how it would play out on the user end.
Yeah. I tell you, the thing, I'm always amazed when I go to Europe. You know, in Europe, everybody has a smart card. And so if I lose my credit card, nobody can use it because it's a unique between the chip on the card and the password that I have in each of the devices to tie that password to that card. And I look, for us, it's a bit of a different issue, actually. I mean, the whole notion of identity theft and knowing who's on the other end of that access to data. You know, we have a hosted project facility, if you will, to allow companies to engage their supply chain to be able to do collaborative work and communicate vis-a-vis projects. And for them, the sensitivity to the data is enormous. Forget just the transaction cost of any individual item. It's about the future revenue streams of their companies. And so security access right now is quite primitive, actually. I mean, it's sophisticated in terms of encryption and you know, username, passwords, but I think the fundamental issue that actually is sort of going to impact every single person, whether it's enterprise or whether it's to consumers, is actual identity, knowing who the person is on the other end that says who they are and making sure it can't be stolen. So I think this notion of a identification system nationwide and worldwide is a critical issue that's going to face us all. I mean, it faces the travel industry. Think about it now, how they try and do it.
Yeah, since 9/11, there's really been a big jump in interest in biometrics, mainly for security and reasons. In fact, there's going to be a discussion on that on Thursday. Alan Brody's group is going to be talking about that if you want to learn more about that.
From a mobile commerce point of view, there's a synergy, if you will. People feel if you're traveling, it's easier to manipulate with voice recognition. At the same time, there's a belief among consumers that voice recognition as a voice print security device is better. It's not necessarily better. It's as good as anything else, but it works hand in hand. So that might be something that's accepted. The only problem with that is this background noise, like automobile noise, so what sometimes can get in the way, but that's a potential mainstream approach to security and fraud.
Sir?
Now, about 70% of our phone calls do clear, and we've eliminated 90% of the fraud. So I don't know if I...
So it sounds like, so people like for every fraud, you end up calling three other networks.
Yeah, for each fraud, we call basically a total of three people.
Okay,
great. Did you have a question down here?
For Patrick, I'm curious to hear how you discovered the business opportunity for Forestock.com. We talked about the DC vision,
what stuck out about it when you saw that business plan?
Well, that as I understood about the liquidation industry, I saw that it was inefficient from an economic point of view. So here's this great big wedge of costs. Basically, jobbers, these guys I'm talking about, get the opportunity to buy goods at half the cost or less than half the cost of wholesale. And that's the way the market compensates them for the fact that they're not a Walmart getting 10,000 identical items that they can retail efficiently. You're getting 62 bread makers, and Sunbeam sends you its last 243 Mickey Mouse waffle makers, but they show up on a pallet, and when they emptied that shelf in their warehouse, there were only 220 because their inventory system was off. So they send you the 220 plus another 50 blenders wrapped in plastic on a pallet as a make good. That's the way this whole industry works. So it was, and because of that, and because it's irregular, the people who operate in it get to buy much cheaper than they do it normally. So they suppose the normal retail chain is somebody makes something for 25, they wholesale it for 50 to a store, and then the store sells it to you for 100. The jobbers out there are buying stuff 10, 15, 20. But then because they're getting three of this and 20 of that and 50 of something else, it goes back up through several layers and enters the retail world again in a discount store at about a 30% discount. Well, what we realized was we could be out there buying this stuff at 15 to 25, sucking it all into one warehouse, putting it on the internet, and selling it at 40 and capturing that difference.
Right. What time are we over here? Is it 4 o'clock? Is that when we're over? Okay, great. Who else has a question? Ma'am.
I was just wondering whether or not there isn't therefore a link between what you do and the consumer end of it. In other words, in the, that somebody tells me, you know, instead of my having to go into Odd Job 4 times when I'm walking, you know, I'm fine because you just take hit or miss, that, oh, yeah, the waffle irons are in or something like that. In other words, that it might facilitate what you call meat commerce.
Well, I see.
As opposed to buying it mail order online wirelessly, that I would actually go into the store because now I know it's on sale and it's for sale.
I see that point. It's actually one of the points we make about this is being a real value shopper in the physical world necessitates going to Odd Jobs or Century 21 twice a week. And how much more convenient it is to get on just, but I see your point because we do have products that sell, that come in and we're sold out in a day because we got 8 of something and they're gone in a day. So conceivably there is a, that's the only kind of, normally it's very rare that I want to buy something and I just have to buy it now. And so that's why I think that it, normally I'm not going to be using my cell phone to buy something. But I could see a situation where you're talking about small amounts of goods that might have an application.
Well, if it was really easy and reliable to use, I think that there would be demand that would arise for that kind of service. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the problem right now, is that it hasn't really shown to be so easy. So, more questions. Who else has a question? Sir.
In the risk-reward continuum, you at least have to have a reward. And when companies say that they have no plans for profit, then you start getting a little concerned. I agree with you, there's a risk, though. But the question is, to what degree should the risk be? I think we got way over rewarding for no reward. People were taking irrational risks.
Right, and look, there was business and startups and entrepreneurialism going on well before the whole dot-com thing happened. Okay, so it wasn't like, you know, we had this brief shining moment where people went crazy, you know, and drank the Kool-Aid and started companies. People have been starting companies for thousands of years, if not longer. The question is, you know, what do we do going forward? And, you know, there's some people who feel sour grapes for having missed the bandwagon and all the free money and things that were around there. You know, I mean, from my perspective as a consultant, you know, did I shift for some working with dot-coms while that happened? Well, of course. You know, one of the tenets of consulting is you don't question why your clients want to pay you money. Did I think that what was going on was ridiculous? Yes. Did I have clients who I knew immediately were going to fail? Yes. But did I bring them value? Absolutely. So the question at the end of the day is, you know, what are you going to do? And, you know, what's the value out there? And where do you want to go look next? Where are you going to put your stake in the ground?
I saw a great, great article that we talked about, an editorial, that talked about the whole I think it was an Upside magazine. They sort of said, you know, the dot-com bubble. And they sort of said, you know, to call it a bubble would not be fair because that presupposes there was no value that was there. And there is value there. There's no doubt. The question, they went on to sort of talk about Geoffrey Moore and, you know, his technology adoption curve. And they sort of said, he went on to sort of say what was disturbing is that a lot of these companies actually went out and became public entities when they had really, quite frankly, no right in becoming public companies until in the past. It used to be, you know, you had to be profitable and you could show growth. And in the past, that would have been controlled by the venture guys because they probably wouldn't have funded the second or third round. Instead, they got funded by the public markets, and that allowed them to survive. I think what's particularly disturbing is that so many people, the businesses that when they did shut down, because they weren't an operating entity, if you will, from a profit standpoint, that when they shut down literally almost overnight. And so I think the interruption that it's caused to businesses that started to build some of these systems and integrate them as part of their processes, it caused some significant disruptions, as well as, of course, the human toll that happened. But if you want the next area where people are putting all the money on the roulette wheel, I think this notion of identity and trying to control on the security side of things, I think that's the next area where there'll be a lot of shakeout. Is it necessary? Yeah. But I think what'll happen now is that you won't see a lot of these companies go public until they're, you know, at least on a path towards profitability, which means the shakeout should be less severe in terms of at least the public awareness.
Right. Patrick, do you want to make some any closing comments, any closing views?
Well, just on that last question, of course, I didn't mean it in an ethical sense that they should not have been funded. Just I think that people should have known better. It has made my life more difficult because we've had somewhere between a tenth to a hundredth of the capital of the people we compete against. And they had lousy business plans, but they had a lot more dumb money behind them, in my opinion. And it meant that it was a little bit tougher for us because we had to weather sort of the subsidies of all the dumb money until it washed away.
John, any last words of wisdom?
The only thing I would say is for anybody who's starting a business is, again, beta test the wallet, because at the end of the day, it's about a business. And then you got to understand value, people have to pay for that value. And ultimately, your costs have to be less than what they're willing to pay.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, this isn't a summary comment, it's an add-on. If you look at major movements where a lot of people focus on technology and applying things, certainly we just saw that and call it a bubble, you call it whatever you want, an investment craze. You look at what NASA and the irrational goal of sending people to the moon, what that did, it's very hard to predict years from now what the payoff's going to be. It's very hard to understand how things are going to change. These things come in cycles. I think it was a very useful cycle. But getting back to Michael's point, if you can't make it better, faster, cheaper, make some money, save some time, or entertain, then you really don't have a market.
Okay, well, we're about out of time. I'd like to thank our panelists, Patrick Byrne, John McElhenney, Alan Koritsky. My name is Michael Drapkin. I want to wish you a very happy and healthy, safe holiday season to you and yours. Let's go knock them dead in 2002. Thank you very much.
Steel products. Okay, Strasburg, VA. We do, actually. Sometimes we do. Okay, well, thank you. I will keep it.
I love that chapter. Well, eliminate the necessary. I'm the CIO.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
There must have been a copy editor.
Yeah,
that's what they do.
Yeah, I mean, he's actually. He's a user interface expert. He's got his PhD in. Truly a brilliant man.
We had a good turnout, actually. It's double what I expected.
Thank you very much. Very nice meeting you.
Pleasure. Good luck.
And you have
a back.
Consulting
Make it
firm
easy for them to shop.
Technology. Take care.
Business and management. Where are you located?
We're located in Concord, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Probably for a couple of our competitors.
How you guys doing?
Very well, sir. We've grown about 30%+ for the past 5 years.
So 30%
profitability, which is rare these days.
Isn't it interesting? You know, you're one of those examples. I thought that was pretty much a sum of market.
It was underserved. Parametric. Parametric had a